Have you ever watched a film, read a book, or viewed a painting and felt an inexplicable urge to talk about it afterward? That impulse to process, analyze, and share your experience is the beating heart of criticism. In our digital age, when everyone with internet access can publish opinions, yet traditional critical voices face extinction, understanding the true nature of criticism has never been more vital. Criticism isn't merely the domain of professionals writing reviews. It's fundamental to human consciousness, as natural as breathing, yet as sophisticated as philosophy. It begins with thinking deeply about our experiences with art, whether that's a Renaissance painting or the latest superhero movie. This impulse challenges the prevalent notion that thinking critically somehow diminishes enjoyment, pushing back against an anti-intellectualism that has become virtually our civic religion in America, even while critical thinking remains an educational buzzword in our schools and universities. Criticism exists in perpetual contradiction. We believe taste cannot dispute it, de gustibus non est disputandum, yet constantly argue about it. Our aesthetic judgments appear as both uncontrollable innate reflexes and carefully acquired sensibilities. They're supposedly private matters that nonetheless define our social identities and cultural tribes. We use polite, subjective language, I think, or in my opinion, while secretly desiring objective certainty, wanting to declare not just I like it, but this is genuinely great. These tensions reveal the foundational questions underlying criticism. How do we know what we know about art? Why do we feel what we feel when experiencing work? What shapes our responses? Personal history, cultural context, or something universal? The critic navigates between personal response and public discourse, between subjective experience and shared understanding. When we engage critically with art, we're not diminishing it, we're honoring our experiences by taking them seriously. The perception of critics as failed artists is entirely wrong. Throughout history, many figures have excelled at both. Baudelaire revolutionized French poetry, while his art criticism defined modernism. French New Wave directors moved from film criticism to revolutionary cinema. George Bernard Shaw transformed theater criticism while writing groundbreaking plays. Criticism isn't secondary. It's art's twin, driven by the same creative impulse to function freely and beautifully and make an articulate noise in the world. The solitary creator is a myth. All recognizable art responds to other art in an endless dialogue. Artists begin as audiences, driven to build upon their predecessors. Contemporary examples include hip-hop's sophisticated sampling, Tarantino's recombination of cinema history, and Lin-Manuel Miranda's reimagining of American history through modern musical forms. The creative process involves loving demystification, breaking down admired works to understand and potentially surpass them. Originality emerges not from isolation, but from deep engagement with tradition, with criticism integral to this process. What happens when we truly engage with art? Marina Abramović's MoMA exhibition, The Artist is Present, drew over 750,000 visitors who waited hours for a brief face-to-face encounter with the silent artist. Many spectators wept, while others experienced profound peace or vulnerability. Abramović was simply present, creating a space for pure human connection through sustained eye contact and shared silence. Many described feeling seen in unprecedented ways, demonstrating art's ability to bypass social conventions and create authentic connections. This transformative potential appears in Rilke's Archaic Torso of Apollo, where readers perceive wholeness from fragments and experience being seen by an eyeless statue. Through precise imagery, Rilke conveys the radiance emanating from the damaged sculpture, turning absence into presence. The poem's final command, "You must change your life," calls us to enter art's transformative realm as willing participants rather than casual observers. Artistic encounters generate intimate knowledge existing outside conventional understanding. Criticism stems from our desire to communicate these experiences, to make them less solitary. It begins with innocent yet risky questions that echo intimate conversations. Did you feel that? Was it good for you? Tell the truth. The modern museum experience often undermines its promised sublime encounters. At the Louvre, 8 million annual visitors crowd to see the Mona Lisa through screens and selfies rather than direct engagement. Museums function as arguments from authority, their institutional judgment overshadowing personal reactions. Their architecture and curation reinforce this power dynamic, making our opinions seem insignificant before works whose value has been predetermined. The question of who decides what's valuable defined the 1990s culture wars, particularly in college curricula debates. Traditionalists defended Western masterworks as inherently superior, while critics viewed these hierarchies as political constructs serving the powerful. Both sides mistakenly treated the canon as fixed rather than what it truly is, a constantly renegotiated list reflecting changing tastes and habits. Democratic consumer societies respond with more discourse, access, and opinions. We replace hierarchy with pluralism, substituting canons with polls, lists, and algorithms reflecting collective preferences. Yet this leveling of taste hierarchies doesn't resolve questions of cultural authority. The consumer economy maintains inequality, replacing barriers of pedigree with barriers of income and access. Our increasing cosmopolitanism also brings standardization, creating global entertainment exemplified by Hollywood's worldwide dominance. Being wrong is not a critic's failure, but their sacred duty. Unlike experts in other fields, critics navigate an uncertain path toward truth. In our data-driven culture that craves certainty, criticism embraces uncertainty as a strength, acknowledging human expression's complexity beyond quantification. Critics inevitably miss the point. Frank Nugent's 1938 dismissal of Bringing Up Baby, now celebrated as classic screwball comedy, shows how critics can be too immersed in current conventions to recognize brilliance. This pattern repeats with Impressionism, jazz, and experimental literature. This myopia stems from critics being imprisoned in the present. They either become overly credulous about novelty or too cynical, dismissing innovations as more of the same. Both conservative impulses to preserve what's valuable and revolutionary drives toward an unseen future have merit, yet neither masters time. One declares the human project complete, the other imagines perfection lies ahead. We need both perspectives to escape the present's exhausting flux. The climactic moment in Pixar's Ratatouille, when the critic tastes Remy's dish and is transported to childhood, embodies criticism's highest purpose, reconnecting with genuine appreciation. Both Remy and critic Anton Ego share the same vocation, the especially intense appreciation of something everyone else either takes for granted or enjoys in a casual way. Just as chefs must understand ingredients and traditions, critics need deep knowledge of form and context to offer valuable insights. The work of criticism is endless as art constantly evolves, yet a true critic knows when to set aside analysis and simply experience art's transformative power. This balance between analytical distance and emotional engagement distinguishes great criticism from mere opinion. In an age of algorithms and instant reactions, thoughtful criticism matters more than ever, not as a consumer guide, but as a fundamental human activity exploring what moves us and who we are. The best criticism enriches our enjoyment by adding layers of meaning to cultural experiences. When we engage critically, we're participating in the collective human project of making meaning together.